I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, the author of the cover story of yesterday's New York Times Magazine, Trump versus Congress. After the president suffered his first defeat on Capitol Hill, can the White House still make good on its legislative promises? It's a fascinating article. Not only does it look at what's going on now, but it looks at some of the meetings that the principals in the Trump administration had some years ago to try and make happen what did eventually happen, the victory of Donald Trump. It's very interesting, the relationship between Donald Trump and Steve Bannon, who has the president's ear, what members of Congress are thinking about Donald Trump, who he can work with, who he can't work with, who he'll have to work with in order to get legislation passed. And we'll look at specific pieces of legislation as well. Our guest is Robert Draper. Robert is an author and a contributing writer to many publications, including the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, GQ. He previously worked for Texas Monthly and is the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush, a chronicle of the Bush administration from 2001 to 2007. Robert, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Kat.
Yeah, wonderful article. Wonderful article. It was really interesting. I think I want to go to history for the beginning part of our conversation, because this meeting with Steve Bannon and I believe it was Steve Miller and Jeff Sessions, this whole planning thing, I thought was so fascinating when Bannon saw that all of these people who were unhappy with Obama sat out, white voters sat out in 2012. And Bannon, I mean, his mind is pretty brilliant politically, looks at them and thinks, we can get these voters if we don't go to the Republican analysis of what went wrong with the election with Romney. We come up with my idea.
Right. Yes. The context for considering this dinner time meeting that took place, as you say, between Steve Bannon, who at the time was the CEO of Breitbart, Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama, who Bannon regarded as his mentor, and Sessions' closest aide, Stephen Miller. The context for this was that the 2012 election had just occurred a couple of months ago. Romney had lost. Reince Priebus, now the chief of staff to the Trump White House, who works alongside Steve Bannon, but at the time the RNC chairman was commissioning a so-called autopsy of the party and what went wrong. And what was understood was that the party, according to folks like Priebus, was going to need to reach out to the Latino voters who had voted for Obama 44 points over Romney, and that one means of achieving this outreach would be a comprehensive immigration reform bill. Bannon and his two kindred spirits at dinner that night thought that exactly the opposite approach was needed. As you mentioned, Kathleen, their view was that the Republican Party shouldn't seek to reach out wholesale to Hispanic voters, but rather to working class voters, particularly the 6.6 million who had stayed home in 2012 but had participated 4 years earlier in 2008. And their belief was that issues relating to trade and issues relating to immigration, not immigration reform, but rather protecting the borders, would be the way to reach those people. In the course of this dinner, Bannon actually said to Jeff Sessions, you should run for president. We need to run you. You're the guy who's got all of these ideas. Bannon warned Sessions, now you're not likely to win, a recognition of the fact that, among other things, Sessions is not the most charismatic politician. But you've got the right ideas. You could win the nomination, if not the election, and at least that's the first step. Sessions was appreciative of Steve Bannon's enthusiasm, but didn't particularly find himself enamored of the idea of running, said he wasn't going to do that, and so by midnight or so, the dinner broke up with Steve Bannon thinking that he needed to find another politician, another presidential aspirant, who would best embody and espouse those ideas. And in fact, a couple of months later, saw that person. It was Donald Trump at the CPAC convention.
Mm-hmm. And figured that was the guy. Isn't it fascinating? Because I remember doing talk shows about this analysis of what went wrong with the Republicans. And everybody was saying, everybody was believing there's no way they can win the presidency again because they've lost, you know, the country is changing, the demographics are changing. They're losing the Latino vote. They're going to lose forever. And he saw something that nobody else was seeing.
That's right. Well, what he was seeing was that, I guess, a couple of things. First of all, that there was the so-called missing missing voter, predominantly working class white voters,
right.
Though Bannon now tells me that also included disaffected black and Latino working class voters as well. Bannon also recognized what I think a lot of Republicans are coming to acknowledge, which is that the Republicans could embrace immigration reform and the like, and it would still be the case that Democrats would be able to get to the left of them, would be able to find something to demonize Republican politicians about, and would still be able to win over Latino voters. Or, conversely, it's possible that certain issues, both social and economic, could attract those same Latino voters without having to embrace immigration, comprehensive immigration reform proposals. And so Bannon, has more or less gone with that. And of course, what he was, this formed the basis of what he now calls economic nationalism, what I suppose Trump would call populism, and what basically forms, the foundation of their governing philosophy.
Mm. And is he driving the agenda and the mind of the Trump administration, or is it?
No, I wouldn't say that, Kathleen. I mean, it's true that to the degree that there is serious, deep, and persistent thinking going on in the administration as to what are we trying in a big picture to accomplish, it's Steve Bannon who's doing that. But that's not to say that he says, let's do ABC, and President Trump says, okay, Steve, thanks, we'll do that. Trump is actually, a fairly complicated man who is not whose ideology is indistinct. It has certain populist reflexes, but that at times makes him look like a Republican, and other times like a Democrat. He is also a manager who is often swayed by the last person who spoke to him, and we saw in the most recent debate to repeal and replace Obamacare that President Trump did not come to the table with some core principles about what this replacement vehicle should be, and I think that hamstrung ultimately the ability of the Republicans to pass something that the man at the top, the chief executive, did not himself know precisely what he wanted this legislation to be.
Hmm, interesting. Well, let's go to another dinner meeting that you start the article with, and that's January 9th, Paul Ryan with members of Trump's inner circle. I'm wondering about the relationship between Paul Ryan and members like Bannon and Priebus and others who are, I know that Priebus and Ryan are close because of Wisconsin, but the meeting that all of those people had to look at fashioning out details for the legislative agenda for this new administration. What were they talking about? And then we have to factor in what happened with the defeat of the health care reform and what that does to all of the things that they were talking about.
Sure. Well, to the dinner that you're mentioning, Kathleen, this took place in January of this year, before Trump's inauguration, at a time in which Speaker Paul Ryan had a kind of shaky relationship not only with the president himself but with his top advisor, Steve Bannon. Now, Speaker Ryan is obviously very close to his fellow Wisconsinite, Reince Priebus, but not with Bannon. This was a dinner that had as its implicit mission, trying to form a bond between those two men, and they achieved it that evening over the subject of tax reform, specifically a package that Speaker Ryan had been working on for really years, and Bannon, I should mention, had never been a fan of Ryan's prior to this. In fact, quite the contrary, he really reviewed Paul Ryan as the epitome of all that was wrong with the Republican Party, that they were heartless, bloodless, had no populist reflex to them at all, that they were all about tax cuts, all about tearing apart the social safety net, and it was kind of this Ayn Rand individualism that really did not make itself identifiable to the American worker. So Bannon never took kindly to Paul Ryan, but Ryan's elucidation that evening of his tax proposal that would include, among other things, a kind of import tax known as the border adjustment tax would, in Bannon's view, trigger a kind of renaissance in the manufacturing sector of America, would in fact be very, very appealing to the working class that Trump and Bannon had courted in 2016. So Bannon actually found himself blurting out at a certain point that evening, I would have to say this looks like, Trump 101. This looks like the first step toward economic nationalism, to which Ryan somewhat took umbrage and said I would actually call it reasonable nationalism. But this was a point at which it looked like there might be some smooth sailing or at least some commonality between Trump's top advisor and the man third in line to the presidency, Speaker Paul Ryan. But then, of course, governance or the attempt at governance ensued, and the opening gambit was health care. And so we know from the recent news what took place with that.
Yeah, so does that mean that Ryan is out of the loop now when it comes to fashioning tax reform?
Not entirely. No, he's not out of the loop. And I wouldn't say that he has now been sort of excommunicated from the Trump church, but he's certainly on probation. Though President Trump has made a point of saying that he doesn't blame Ryan for the failures, Trump has instead blamed Democrats. He has blamed the House conservatives known as the Freedom Caucus, and of course in a more globalized sense he blames the fake news media. But despite all of that, it's clear that he feels led astray, and I think not unreasonably, by Speaker Ryan for having fashioned a legislative package that he really couldn't get the votes for. Paul Ryan failed to recognize that he understood that Democrats weren't going to vote for the overturning of a major Democratic initiative such as Obamacare, but he failed to understand how his own conservatives within the Republican conference would not be on board with that. Now, Trump's going to need Paul Ryan for tax reform, and this is very much his baby. That I think that both at opposite ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, the Republicans are consoling themselves by saying, you know, health care, that's always a tough one. It's an emotional issue. Tax reform is, you know, playing our kind of game. We all sort of think the same way. We all are into tax cuts. This one's going to be a lot easier. Of course, we heard that same kind of language when it came to Obamacare, because one thing every Republican could agree on, it was that Obamacare was a disaster that needed to be repealed, and yet that did not result in sufficient consensus to pass the legislation. So we'll see what happens with tax reform.
I want to talk just a little bit, because you are in a rare position. Most of us have not had possibility of speaking with the president, and you spoke with him on the campaign trail, and you've had quite a few telephone conversations with him. When he's talking to you, you include some of this in the article. He talks about, we've done a whole lot. I think we've done more than anybody for this short period of time. And you mentioned Abraham Lincoln and FDR and Lyndon Johnson, who might take exception to this claim. Is he bragging about how wonderful he has been? Does he seem bored with things? Is he easily distracted? Do you have a sane conversation with him?
Well, so the most recent conversation I had with him was on March the 3rd. It was the day after Speaker Ryan had introduced his health care package, and it was hours before the House conservatives basically said no thanks to that package. So the president, in that sense, was feeling somewhat sanguine. At the same time, he was also a bit defensive, because it was 6 weeks into his presidency, and people were already saying, you know, he hasn't really done anything. A few executive orders, sure, but some of those are tied up in the federal courts, and in any event, we have not really seen how this man's going to get along with a co-equal branch of government. I think that he sounded a little more terse and a little bit less, happy, for lack of a better way of putting it, than during the many times that I'd spoken with him on the campaign trail, when he would largely be jetting from one adoring crowd to the next, was getting tons and tons of attention, and it was at that stage that getting attention was really all that was important, regardless of what kind of attention it was. I think as well, Kathleen, both then when I spoke to him and today, he is struggling with the art of governance and surrounding himself now with people who are altogether different than, you know, Chinese negotiators or something. It's also a different language for him. I mean, I remember being on an airplane with him, listening to him talk casually with his son, negotiating elevator construction rates, land acquisition factors. Mm. This is a language he's literally been speaking for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And now, all of a sudden, he's having to learn, you know, the language of sequestration, of reconciliation bills. He's having to learn the parochial concerns of 535 elected federal officials. And he doesn't sound terribly happy about it. Now, I must say, all of that can and will change once he scores a victory. More than anything else, he is hungry for a win. And once he feels like he is a winner on this turf of Washington, he's going to enjoy himself a great deal more. That hasn't happened yet.
Mm. Well, you also write in the article extensively about his point people on the Hill, the people who are supposed to help him get his agenda passed. And let's spend some time on Representative Kevin McCarthy, who I love the details in your article, whose girlfriend gave him a copy of The Art of the Deal. He later married her back in the 80s. So this is Trump's guy, one of his guys in the House. But maybe those people don't seem to be as strong as they need to be to help out the president.
Well, so just to be clear, Kevin McCarthy, as far as I know, did not marry his girlfriend because she gave him.
No, I didn't mean to say that. I know it. But who knows? Maybe so. Maybe it was the best president
very,
ever.
Very appreciative of it. Kevin McCarthy, who is a natural politician, and like Donald Trump, has pretty good people skills and is more interested in personalities than in policy, nonetheless has struggled over the years at counting heads and has faced a lot of criticism on the Hill for that. Nonetheless, I can't put all of this, and I don't think anybody reasonably could put the failure of Obamacare or, the sort of lurching methodology of the legislative branch in the Trump era on, the House Majority Leader. There are a lot of factors here, and again, I think they start with the top. There's a lot of chaos at the executive branch. The legislative branch is raring to go. They are anxious to get tax reform going. I do put at the feet of the Republican conference their failure in the previous 7 years to develop a consensus as to what a replacement for Obamacare would be like. They did have the time and they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Though President Trump told me he had, quote, big input, unquote, into the making of the American Health Care Act that failed. I doubt that the input was so big that it required House Republicans and Senate Republicans basically doing nothing for the last 7 years. Though now we come on to things like tax reform, where the contours, presumably the Trump White House, having learned from the experience of the health care debacle, are going to want to be very much a part of shaping what this tax reform package will be. It will not just be Speaker Ryan's. So now there's going to have to be a lot of teamwork involved that we didn't see nearly as much in the opening stages of health care. After that comes infrastructure, and frankly, very few people on the Hill have any idea what President Trump has in mind for that. I tried to tease some of that out from him and from Steve Bannon in my interviews with them, and they've been quite vague. They've also been vague not only about precisely what sort of infrastructure schemes they have in mind, but how precisely they would pay for it. They keep saying it'll be $1 trillion and it'll be public-private. But the devil is very much in the details, and House Republicans will definitely agree with that, too.
Mm. What about the wall, Robert?
Well, I mean, President Trump has told me that it's going to take a couple of years at minimum to construct it, but that they are already appropriating funds for it. Those monies are emergency funds, in essence. The campaign pledge that Mexico would pay for it is apparently something we should not have taken literally. Everyone now is in agreement that Americans will be paying for it up front, and perhaps through remittances, import taxes, or whatever else Mexico may pay for it or not. It also remains to be seen whether what has been allotted in emergency appropriations through the Department of Homeland Security for the construction of the wall is really for the blueprint for the construction of the wall. It's going to cost, though President Trump said to me he was absolutely confident that they would get very, very low bids and that he would come in, under everybody's expectations. Even if you take that into account, it's going to be, let's say, a minimum of $15 billion. And there are a lot of, pretty much every Democrat on the Hill is going to vote against that. And a lot of Republicans are going to vote against it if they don't find the Trump administration, if they don't find, some means of paying for it other than squeezing revenues from the American taxpayer. Mm.
I believe it was John McCain you interviewed who had some interesting response to how Mexico is going to respond to all of this.
Yeah, he said frankly, that response has already begun, according to Senator McCain, that you were already getting a sense of anti-American sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
It could give rise to a very anti-American, somewhat leftist Mexican president in their next election. So this is the law of unintended consequences, and that's before the construction of the wall. That's before the issuance, should it come to pass, of a border adjustment tax. If that should come to be, then there may well be a trade war, and not only between Mexico and the U.S., but also between other countries such as China and the United States, which could have, to say the least, global repercussions, economically speaking.
Hmm. So that's going to be talked about at Mar-a-Lago probably over the weekend.
I suspect so, yes.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls for Robert. Robert Draper is our guest. If you didn't have a chance to read his article, it's on our Facebook page. It's very, very well done. It's very interesting and not only looks at what's going on right now with the Trump administration's early days in office, the disastrous defeat of the health care bill, but also some really keen insights as to how Steve Bannon particularly saw something in the country that a lot of other people didn't see, and a lot of Republicans didn't see, that resulted in the election of Donald Trump to the presidency. Robert has covered Trump on the campaign trail, and he's talked to Donald Trump many times as president and as president-elect, and also with people who are in this administration, so he has a unique and keen insight. Robert Draper is an author, contributing writer to many publications. Yesterday's piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, the cover story, actually, Trump v. Congress, after the president suffered his first defeat on Capitol Hill, can the White House still make good on its legislative promises? He has worked for Texas Monthly, for GQ and National Geographic, writes for them, and is the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. Our phone number, join us, please, we'd love to hear from you, is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, two phone calls now for Robert. We start with Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. You know, I've heard a lot of pundits talk about this election, and I don't necessarily disagree with them. It was a historic election, but I think it's much more nuanced. I think it was a combination. I've heard that Donald Trump was paying a lot of attention to right-wing radio talk and the sort of anger, nationalism, racism, all these sort of things that was appealed to through right-wing radio, and he kind of tapped into that. So I see him more as an opportunist who won the election because he promised so much. And then when the Russian fake news and interference in our election, plus the email releases, and the email releases in particular that said that the Democratic Party was working against Bernie Sanders, that sat down a lot of young millennial Bernie Sanders supporters who were excited about the election, who thought that things could change in this country. So they didn't come out to vote. And then Hillary Clinton wasn't the kind of candidate that really appealed to the base of the Democratic Party, you know, working people, wage earners and things like that. So those people weren't excited. But Donald Trump did excite these people who were angry about how their wages had been, you know, not raised in mm-hmm. 30 years and diminished. And anyways, so I think that it was a combination of all that. And, you know, even his inauguration was poorly attended, and I think that his presidency is not exactly exciting the nation, and I think that.
All right, let's get a response. We have a lot of calls. Robert.
Sure. Basically, I agree with almost everything that the caller just mentioned. There were many, many factors contributing to Donald Trump's victory, and I think overwhelmingly, the greatest factor was antipathy towards Hillary Clinton, particularly in the battleground states where Donald Trump won but did not win convincingly. I mean, it's not as if in Wisconsin or in Pennsylvania or Michigan, you know, he won by large margins. He did in double digits in Ohio, but in those particular states, exit polls were pretty clear that there was a kind of an ineffable but distinct recognition that change needed to occur, that Donald Trump could be that agent of change. There were a lot of people in those states who stayed home because they were not terribly excited about Hillary Clinton. It is true that that Trump appealed to a base that comprised not only conservatives, but also largely white working-class voters, many of whom who had identified as Democrat, or at least voted for President Obama in 2008 and perhaps also 2012, but who now felt like a change had to occur. Perhaps a component of that was consisted of racists. Perhaps it's indisputable that Russians meddled or attempted to meddle in the election. It is impossible to say the degree to which, if at all, they influenced that election. I'm not sure that I would infer from Donald Trump's relatively small compared to Barack Obama's 2008 inaugural gathering that there is a sudden deflated enthusiasm for Trump. Also, Obama, let's face it, in 2009, that was truly historic insofar as it was unimaginable a couple of decades ago to reckon that we would see an African American as president. So but the larger point, I not only concede but have written about myself that that it's not as if Donald Trump swept victory by huge margins and with a clear mandate to change. And further, his relatively low, in fact, historically low, favorability ratings at this juncture indicate, a dissatisfaction amongst the electorate at large, if not from his own base. So I think his base actually has not moved a muscle, and I think that it's going to take a lot for them to move away from Donald Trump.
Here's my problem with the base and their embrace of what we're seeing in the Trump administration. So explain this to me. You talk in the article about those people who were alienated by Romney's perceived elitism. These voters were gettable. And yet we've got this incredible administration. People keep writing about, every day it's something different. Yesterday it's Jared and Ivanka are worth $740 million. We've got Betsy DeVos, who's worth billions of dollars. Where's the farmer from Nebraska who is supposed to be head of, the Department of Agriculture? So you've got some measure of populism. I mean, this sure isn't a populist kind of philosophy, is it?
Well, I guess what I would say to that is that Franklin Roosevelt was quite wealthy himself, and his wealth did not put off his constituents. I don't think that that Trump's voters either were put off by his wealth or by the wealth of those with whom he has surrounded himself. If anything, I think they view this as a mark of successful individuals who now perhaps hold the key to success for America writ large. I don't think any of them begrudge President Trump or his inner circle the fortunes that they have amassed. It remains to be seen, Kathleen, whether they're going to begrudge President Trump, whether they will hold him accountable for example, this very austere budget blueprint that his administration is promulgating, which would have deep cuts in housing and in education and other programs that are certain to affect, almost seem targeted for Trump voters. Now, having said that, I mean, we have heard Democrats say over and over and over again, how could these, dumb working class voters, vote against their economic self-interest. All they're doing is voting for Republicans who then push for tax cuts for the wealthy. And what that tells you is that, Democrats themselves have been out of touch with what working class voters are about, it's not just that they want an array of social programs. It's not that they want to see, the advancement of civil rights. Democrats have really hung their hats on that kind of argument for some time and have not shown many electoral gains because of it.
Let's go. Thanks, Willem, for your call. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hey, hi. I'm calling because I heard a little bit of a segment on the show Here and Now the other day, and it was all about a very, very rich man named Robert Mercer who sounded like he has really had similar plans to Steve Bannon about how he saw the voters available and went after them with a populist message, all the while planning to institute policies that would, you know, like you were just saying, that would hurt the people who voted for them. And I didn't hear much of it, and I've never heard of this Robert Mercer person.
Yeah, you write about him in the piece yesterday.
Yeah, but only sidelong. Many of my colleagues have written about the Mercers. Steve Bannon is close to Robert Mercer, much closer to Mercer's daughter, Rebecca. And it is true that the Mercers have a very, very anti-government view, that they have become just as fed up with the Republican establishment, or at least almost as much as they have with Democrats, and basically believe that, you know, to use the parlance of Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, that government should be shrunk down to the size where it can be strangled in a bathtub. And they were big donors to Trump throughout the 2016 campaign, particularly in its latter stages, and remain very, very close to Bannon and to Trump to this day.
And thanks very much for your call. We go next to Dennis in Wautoma. Hi, Dennis.
Hey there. How are you doing today?
All right. How are you?
Not bad. My question for your guest is what he thinks, if any, the Trump effect will be on job creation. Because I know that, you know, you relaxed all these EPA regulations against the auto industry and big coal, but from what I'm hearing and reading, coal isn't likely to make any kind of a comeback. China canceled plans for 100 coal-fired electrical generating plants last year and is moving ahead with renewables. Renewables is almost at 25% of our electric generation here, and I hear that our own, because of fracking, our own utilities have canceled coal-fired plants and are moving to gas. And since Trump's been elected, although he's been touting a lot of big job savings he claims he's done, I keep reading about places that are laying off left and right, including Carrier. So I'm just wondering what you're thinking is. I know that the president always gets credit if the economy does well and usually gets blamed if it doesn't, but in reality, they don't really have that much effect on the economy at all.
No, that's true. Well, I don't want to make light of any of the efforts that President Trump has made thus far regarding job creation. You mentioned Carrier, for example, Dennis, and Joe Donnelly, the senator from Indiana, where Carrier is headquartered, gives President-elect Trump, he was president-elect then, a lot of credit for going down to Indiana and talking with the employees there and then talking with executives of Carrier, and helping to assure that at least some of the jobs that Carrier had intended to move to Mexico would stay in Indiana. And he has done other outreach as well. He also has been talking, for example, to Senator Joe Manchin in West Virginia about trying to keep jobs for coal miners there. Having said all of that, President Trump, well, at least his top advisor, Steve Bannon, has conceded to me that the chief job creation program will be in the form of the $1 trillion infrastructure program, and that will involve presumably high-speed rail, roads, bridges, and other such projects, which is why there is a kind of urgency in the Trump administration now as they talk about tax reform and if they're talking about health care, that maybe in the long term jobs will be created as a result of these measures, but they'd really like some shovel ready things that are visual and semi immediate to occur. That would then require the passage of an infrastructure bill, which is going to be a very, very tricky thing to do, given that Republicans, many of them, will view this as just a glorified stimulus project. And Democrats, while this is more to their liking, this kind of program, may also just want Donald Trump, President Trump, to twist in the wind after he's already failed with health care and not be of the mind to help them, particularly when we are likely to see the deployment of the nuclear option to pass to confirm the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch by a 51-vote majority.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's he going to need to do? Let's look at health care. Let's say that they're going to refashion something and make it palatable to most Republicans and also entice some Democrats. A couple questions here. Who does he have who's a master negotiator who can bring these factions together? Two, do you think that he will move ahead on this because they promised to repeal and replace? It was a big campaign promise. And three, do you think that will happen sometime soon or not?
Well, okay, so as for master negotiators in the White House, he has some smart people there, like Vice President Mike Pence, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, and Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, who are all very close to and really hail from the House conservatives who now call themselves the Freedom Caucus. They would presumably be disposed to be the kinds of negotiators President Trump needs for this. But those guys were on the Hill for the last go-around, and nothing good came of it. I really don't know what the solution is here. I mean, Speaker Ryan is hoping to cobble something together and do it quickly, and I think President Trump would like to see that as well. But the Freedom Caucus is saying not so fast. We want to have input into this. And by the way, let's not forget the fact, Kathleen, that throughout all these conversations relating to health care, we haven't even begun to talk about the Senate and what they may have to say on this subject. What is absolutely clear is that it will not get past the Senate, even a 51 vote majority, if Medicaid expansion is taken out. There are already some four moderate senators who are Republicans who have said as such. So I really don't know what the fate is going to be there. And it's a conundrum that the Trump White House hates, because this is not their natural issue. This was really, it was a campaign slogan that Trump said over and over. Obamacare is a disaster, and we're going to replace it with something terrific. He never said what the something terrific was, because he didn't know what the something terrific was. If this amounted to campaign mop-up duty, they figured that they'd do this right away. This is the last thing that President Trump wants to preoccupy himself with, and it's also not fitting. It's not in keeping with the economic nationalist portfolio of Steve Bannon. It's not his thing either. So it's really kind of a tar baby for them that they've struggled to extricate themselves from.
Well, what is his thing? I'm thinking about what you said earlier when he was with his son in an airplane during the campaign, and they were talking about this building project, and he's really into that. What's his thing in the White House, his president?
I'm glad you asked me that, because on one of those plane rides, I remember candidate Trump saying to me the two things that he most looked forward to as president of the United States was first to be able to create jobs, and secondly to be able to negotiate with foreign leaders. Now, those are two skills, Kathleen, that are transferable from his prior life as a builder. I'm creating, constructing things, and in the process creating jobs, he can do that. Negotiating with people from, foreign governments about this or that agreement, he's done that as well. So those are the things he'd like to do. He'd like, clearly, to redo trade agreements, and he would like to create jobs. Now, we've talked about jobs and infrastructure. Trade is going to be something else again, because your viewers may not be aware of the fact that to pass a new trade agreement requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate. That means he's got to get some upwards of eight or so. I'm sorry, I'm losing my math here, but in any event, he's going to need about 15 or so Democratic senators, while keeping every Republican on board. And I can guarantee you, having spoken to, say, Senator John McCain, that he and perhaps a Senator John Cornyn of Texas and other Republican senators along the border are not going to be passing anything that altogether throws out NAFTA. And the renegotiation of the WTO and the TPP, these are going to be really, really heavy lifts. And I think that some Democrats, particularly moderate senators in states that Trump carried big in 2016, and these senators are going to be up for re-election next year, they may give it a long look, but President Trump is going to need a lot more than four or five Democratic senators to get these trade agreements passed.
Listener Paul writes, I begrudge Trump his wealth and influence, because much reporting substantiates and documents how he pursued it by repeated breach of contract and good faith. In my opinion, this is not an ethical man. I do not view his wealth and influence to have an ethical basis, nor to exercise one.
That could be. It's, I mean, it's uh, the The listener is certainly entitled to his or her opinion, and is hardly alone in the view that Trump is not an altogether, you know, ethically above board individual. That doesn't mean he can't get some good things accomplished. I mean, lots of good things happened from bad people or for the wrong reasons. What I concentrate on in this particular story is his legislative agenda, and you know the challenges that face him, both in a very divided nation, with a very slender majority in the Senate that will, in many cases, require him working with Senate Democrats, and on the other side of the Capitol with a very fractious group of House Republicans, some of whom are eager to work with President Trump, some who are not altogether on board with, you know, or just are wary of what his ideology is, and some who are real hardliners and may like President Trump, but, you know, have been saying no for several years now and have yet to learn how to say yes to a legislative initiative.
Dennis, thanks for your call. More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour is Robert Draper, author, contributing writer. He has the cover story of yesterday's New York Times Magazine, which is on our Facebook page, or maybe it's on your kitchen table and you just haven't read it yet, or maybe you have and you want to give us your response. The article is titled Trump versus Congress. After the president suffered his first defeat on Capitol Hill, can the White House still make good on its legislative promises? Robert writes for a number of publications, including National Geographic, New York Times Magazine, GQ. He has previously worked for Texas Monthly. Is the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. This is the Ideas Network. We have time for a few more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Ray in Rhinelander is our next caller. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Once again, excellent guest. And Robert, it's I'm very respectful of you. You know, you did a really good job about being involved with Trump, however, with the way you did the personality and psychological profile of him. I'm very impressed with that. You've given people an idea of the workings of the man's behaviors, mind somewhat more with the contact. I compliment you on that. Also, I live in a very rural America, a part of America in the upper Midwest, in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And rural America felt like they weren't being represented, the Christian sector didn't, and that's why he got voted in up here. I did not vote for him, but that's besides the point. The other thing I'm concerned about, and a lot of the people that did vote for him up here now, because I talk to all kinds of different people, that's just realistic in the world, the Republican Party really did not support Donald Trump. They didn't want Hillary to get in, and so now they're kind of stuck with Trump. And they have a profile that people are picking up on that they're kind of stuck with him, and they're not going to cooperate with this Health Care Act, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, also the because of this, he is having a hard time with everything he wants to do, and so... And between the Republican Party of the Senate and Paul Ryan, they have Pence put in, and they're kind of like mining companies. Mining companies work on 40-year plans. I mean, they have plans within plans. So if Trump decides not to finish or it doesn't work out, they've got Pence. So
all right, Ray, where are we going?
I'm just relating some of the ideas that people talk about up here. And, Robert, I'd really like to hear your opinion, and thanks for the excellent job you did about personality with Trump.
Okay. Thank you for the nice words, Ray. I appreciate it. I'll say a couple of things about this. First, that it's not a gratuitous pursuit to talk about President Trump's personality. I mean, beyond the obvious fact that people are interested in it, my experience, particularly in covering the Bush White House and spending so much time with President George W. Bush, is that presidencies, for better or for worse, are very much driven by the personality of the individual inhabiting the Oval Office. And it is a very personal decision, in turn, to vote for such a person. And I think that Ray is right that there are, you know, some people who were who didn't like Hillary or other people who were really ignited by, I mean, whose curiosities were very much ignited by Donald Trump. And some may already be disappointed by him, but I think that he has kind of triggered the imagination, sometimes for the good, sometimes not so much. It is absolutely clear that if Donald Trump's objective were to seize the world's attention, he has completely succeeded. And the second thing that I'll say on this, to what the caller was mentioning, is that you know, there is a glass half full way of looking at this presidency. Not only the fact that it's only about 75 days in to, you know, what's going to be at minimum 4 years, but that certain things have been positively accomplished. Not only in terms of just basic signals he has sent about relating to refugee bans. If that's, you know, if you agree with him, then you feel good about that. But also the nomination and what is likely to be successful confirmation of Judge Gorsuch is a huge score for conservatives, for people who were very doubtful of this man's credentials, conservative credentials. He has clearly pleased them. I will say to that President Trump or candidate Trump really farmed out this activity, the selection of potential nominees to the Federalist Society and to Heritage. They drew up the list, and he looked at it without comment, without any insertions, without any deletions, and then ultimately picked one of them. But that one person is someone who conservatives are very pleased with. So there certainly are things that that those people who voted for him can point to and say, so far, so good.
Well, except for the travel ban. I mean, that's been shot down by judges all over the country. It's kind of nothing's happening with it. You've got
Well, that's right. It's tied up in federal courts right now, and I think that, you know, most reasonable people, certainly most learned people who see it, what's taken place was that it was drawn up in a very slipshod fashion and did not achieve the objectives they wanted. I mean, having it fought out in the Ninth Circuit of Washington, it can give them an opportunity to rail out against liberal judges. But I think they would rather just have the travel ban ratified than spending their time fighting the courts.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. Thanks, Ray, for your call. Craig in Chicago. Hi.
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 So my question is there an individual in the Trump organization who has the talent to take apart and put back together the economy from the standpoint of looking at the industries that need to be stimulated, how to stimulate them, such that the jobs that are promised can actually develop? It just smacks so far of flailing about in that whole area. And the mentioning of infrastructure, for example, and touting that that's going to be the big ticket for developing jobs, in the same breath with manufacturing industries that have closed and gone abroad, is an example, because obviously infrastructure jobs have an entirely different skill set than manufacturing jobs. And even if a big infrastructure bill were to pass, those jobs require skilled trades, which isn't what you find inside manufacturing.
You're exactly right. I mean, there's building, rebuilding a road does not require, the reopening of a steel plant that closed down in Youngstown, Ohio. As for the economic brain trust of the Trump administration, I really don't fault them. They have yet to be fully, deployed. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, is a smart man. Steve Mnuchin, Secretary of the Treasury, the same thing. It's the failure thus far, although I think failure is too strong a word, what's taken place thus far is a preoccupation on the Hill with other matters, and infrastructure is going to have to come after tax reform. As a logistical matter, there was somebody who leaked from the White House, I think it was wishful thinking on their part, that tax reform and infrastructure would take place at the same time. That seems ill-advised to me, since mastering the art of the legislature legislative deal is probably something that they should learn one bill at a time rather than two at a time, and they hadn't yet learned it with health care. So we'll see. But, yes, that's right. I do know that the Trump White House has, you know, a kind of in-house commission that has been devising an infrastructure plan, but whatever they devise is going to have to pass muster and go through a very, very tricky gauntlet in the legislative branch.
Mm. Robert, excellent article, and thank you ever so much for being with us this hour. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Robert Draper, our guest this hour, his piece is the cover story of yesterday's New York Times Magazine, and you can see it on our Facebook page, or you can get it online, I'm sure, as well. He is an author. He is the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. It's a chronicle of the Bush administration. He's also written many pieces for the New York Times Magazine, for GQ, for National Geographic, and this particular piece appears yesterday. It's interesting because it does some historical work, too, that I haven't read anywhere else. I think you'll find it, those of you who like politics, quite intriguing. The article is Trump versus Congress. After the president suffered his first defeat on Capitol Hill, can the White House still make good on its legislative promises? Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour, and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We're with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Looking forward to talking with you again with interesting guests. Right now, news is coming up from NPR.